people's flaws need to be written about. The flaws of some people lead to horrors inflicted on others. And then there are the more human flaws that, when you shine a light on them, de-demonise people who might otherwise be seen as ogres. But there was a side of Michael's business I respected, the side that offered salvation to people who'd really done nothing wrong but had been dramatically shamed anyway, like Justine Sacco. Which is why I now emailed Michael's publicist, Leslie Hobbs, suggesting Justine as Gregory's replacement. "I think she's a deserving case," I wrote. "She may not go for it, but should I at least put it to her as a possibility?" Leslie didn't reply to my email. I sent another one asking why they didn't want to consider taking Justine on. She didn't reply to that one either. I took the hint. I didn't want to lose their goodwill, so I threw Justine on the fire and came up with a new name, a public shamee I'd written to 3 times and had heard nothing back, Lindsay Stone. It was the first time I'd ever been in a position to offer an incentive to a reluctant interviewee. I'd witnessed other journalists do it and had always glared at them with hatred from across the room. 20 years ago I covered the rape trial of a British TV presenter. Journalists on the press benches were shooting him likeable little smiles in the hope of an exclusive interview should he be found not guilty. It was embarrassing and futile too. On the day of his acquittal, a woman in a fur coat appeared in court from nowhere and whisked him away. It turned out that she was from the News of the World. Everyone else, with his or her little likeable smiles, had never stood a chance. This woman had a checkbook. I still had no checkbook, but without Michael's inducement, I'd have had no chance with Lindsay, and it was quite the inducement. "We'll end up spending hundreds of thousands of bucks on her," Michael said. "At least 100 grand, up to several 100 grand of effort." "Hundreds of thousands," I said. "Her situation is very dire," he said. "Why does it cost so much?" I asked him. "Take it up with Google," he shrugged. "It sucks to be Lindsay Stone." I thought Michael was being unbelievably generous. I didn't tell Lindsay that she nearly lost out to Justine Sacco and the leader of a religious group who had been falsely accused of murdering his brother. Gregory's story had over-beguiled me, but Lindsay was perfect. With Lindsay there were no strange caveats, no domineering emails. All she wanted was to work with autistic children and not feel the terror. "If Michael takes you on, that photograph might practically vanish," I said to her. "That would be unbelievable," she replied. "Or if it just disappeared 2 pages down Google, only creepy people check past the second page." Lindsay knew it wasn't perfect. My book would inevitably bring it all back up again, but she understood that anything would be better than the way things were now. She was being offered hundreds of thousands of dollars in free services. This was bespoke, a shaming eradication service that only the super-rich could normally afford. After I left Lindsay's house, she and Michael talked on the phone. After that, Michael called me. She was nothing but very gracious and responsive and cooperative, he said. "I think we can proceed." For scheduling reasons, Michael couldn't start on Lindsay for a few months, so I took a break. I've worked on dark stories before, stories about innocent people losing their lives to the FBI, about banks hounding debtors until they commit suicide. But although I felt sorry for those people, I wouldn't feel the dread snake its way into me in the way that these shaming stories had. I'd leave Jonah and Michael and Justine feeling nervous and depressed. And so it was a nice surprise to receive an email from Richard Branson's sister Vanessa inviting me to appear at a salon of talks at her Marrakesh Palace / holiday home / hotel, the Riyadh El Fen. Other speakers, she emailed, include Clive Stafford Smith, human rights lawyer, David Chipperfield, architect, Hans Ulrich Obrist, serpentine curator, Redhar Moali, rags-to-riches Algerian arts entrepreneur. I googled her Riyadh. It combines grandeur and historic architecture with hideaway nooks, terraces and gardens. And so it was that 4 weeks later, I sat reading a book underneath an orange tree in Vanessa Branson's Marrakesh courtyard. Vanessa Branson lay supine on a velvet bed in the corner. Her friends lounged around, drinking herbal teas. One had been the CEO of Sony in Germany, another owned a diamond mine in South Africa. I was feeling tired and jittery and less languid than the others, who were dressed in white linens and seemed carefree. Then I heard a noise. I looked up from my book. Vanessa Branson was rushing across the courtyard to welcome someone new. He too was dressed in linen and was tall and thin, with the gait of a British man of privilege. He might have been a diplomat. After a few minutes, he bounded over to me. "I'm Clive Stafford Smith," he said. I knew a little about him from his interview on BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Discs, about how he was all set for a life in British society, until one day at his boarding school he saw a drawing in a book of Joan of Arc being burned at the stake and realised she looked like his sister. So in his 20s he became a death row lawyer in Mississippi and has been defending death row and Guantanamo prisoners ever since. The Desert Island Discs presenter, Sue Lawley, treated him with baffled amazement, as Queen Victoria would a lord who had gone off to explore darkest Africa. 10 minutes after meeting me, he was walking me through the corridors of Vanessa Branson's labyrinthine palace, telling me why prisons should be abolished. "Let me ask you 3 questions, he said, "and then you'll see it my way. Question one. What's the worst thing that you have ever done to someone? It's okay, you don't have to confess it out loud. Question two, what's the worst criminal act that has ever been committed against you? Question three, which of the two was the most damaging for the victim?" The worst criminal act that has ever been committed against me was burglary. How damaging was it? It's hardly damaging at all. I felt theoretically violated at the idea of a stranger wandering through my house, but I got the insurance money. I was mugged one time. I was 18. The man who mugged me was an alcoholic. He saw me coming out of a supermarket. "Give me your alcohol," he yelled. He punched me in the face, grabbed my groceries and ran away. There wasn't any alcohol in my bag. I was upset for a few weeks, but it passed. And what was the worst thing I've ever done to someone? It was a terrible thing. It was devastating for them. It wasn't against the law. Clive's point was that the criminal justice system is supposed to repair harm, but most prisoners, young, black, have been incarcerated for acts far less emotionally damaging than the injuries we non-criminals perpetrate upon each other all the time. Bad husbands, bad wives, ruthless bosses, bullies, bankers. I thought about Justine Sacco. How many of the people piling in on her had been emotionally damaged by what they had read? As far as I could tell, only one person was damaged in that pile-on. "I'm writing a book about public shaming," I told Clive. "With Citizen Justice, we're bringing public shame back in a big way. You've spent your life in actual courts. Is it the same there? Is shaming utilised as a kind of default position in real courtrooms too?" "Oh yes," he replied quite happily. "I do it all the time. I've humiliated a lot of people, especially experts." "What's your method?" I asked him. "Oh, it's a very simple game," he said. "You need to figure out something that's so esoteric the expert can't possibly know about it. Maybe it's something that's not relevant to the case, but it has to be something they cannot know the answer to. They'll be incapable of saying they don't know, so they'll gradually walk down the garden to the place where they look really stupid." "Why are they incapable of saying they don't know?" "It's their entire profession," Clive said. "It's respect. It's a big deal being an expert. Imagine things you can discuss at dinner parties as opposed to all the other boring people at the table. You're the witness who put Ted Bundy away. They'll do anything to not look stupid. That's the key thing, and if you can make them look stupid, everything else falls by the wayside." Clive made it sound like shaming was as natural as breathing in the courtroom, and had been forever. And of course I understood that witnesses needed to be grilled, their honesty tested. But it's odd that so many of us see shaming the way free market libertarians see capitalism, as a beautiful beast that must be allowed to run free. Those of us on social media were just starting out on our shaming crusade. In the real courts, according to Clive, it was venerated as a first-line tactic. I wondered, when shaming takes on a disproportionate significance within an august institution, when it entrenches itself over generations, what are the consequences? What does it do to the participants? Chapter 12. The Terror. A dozen men and women sat around a conference table at the Piccadilly Hotel in Manchester. There was a marine metallurgist, a paediatric nurse, an occupational therapist specialising in brain injuries, a laboratory technician working with the Metropolitan Police Drug Squad, someone from the tobacco industry, a social worker who visits the homes of parents suspected of abusing or neglecting their children, and so on. These people had just one thing in common. They were rookie court expert witnesses. They were all hoping to make extra money from the court world. Like me, they didn't know the minutiae of how a day in court worked. None of them had yet been called as an expert, which is why they had signed up for this courtroom familiarisation course, organised by the legal training company, Bonsolon. I had signed up after my conversation with Clive. I was curious to know if shaming was a significant enough part of the court milieu to mention a merit in a courtroom familiarisation course. It merited a mention straight away. There was a whiteboard. Our trainer for the day, John, stood next to it. "You," he told us, by way of introduction, "are a bone being dragged over by two dogs that want to win, and if you get between the lawyer and his goal, you are going to get hurt." He surveyed the room. "Appreciate what the lawyer is trying to do. The lawyer hopes to drag you down. He'll call you incompetent, inexperienced. You might start to feel angry, upset. He will try and drag you outside your area of expertise, your circle of facts. How? How will he try this?" There was a silence. Then it dawned on the rookie experts this wasn't a rhetorical question. "Facial expression?" the marine metallurgist said. "What do you mean?" said John. "Smiling or not smiling," the metallurgist said, "looking unmoved, lulling us into a false sense of security and then pouncing, looking bored." John wrote the suggestions down on the whiteboard. "Unnervous with a disbelieving, patronising or sarcastic voice?" asked a social worker. "Might they snigger?" the lab technician asked. "No, that would sound unprofessional," said John. "But they might go for incredulity. They might say, 'Really?'" "What would happen if I nervously laugh?" the lab technician said. "Sometimes when I'm under pressure, I nervously laugh." "Don't," John warned. "If you do, they'll say, 'Are you finding it funny? My client isn't.'" "Are we allowed to ask them to stop if it gets too much for us?" the marine metallurgist said. "No," said John, "you aren't allowed to ask them to stop. Any other guesses?" "Pretend to mispronounce your name," someone said. "Silence," someone else said. Everyone cringed at the thought of silence. "Should we be concerned about the colour of our clothes?" asked a care worker. "I hear someone wearing brown is considered less believable." "That's too deep for me," said John. I assumed that by lunchtime John would move away from shaming familiarisation to other types of courtroom familiarisation. But really, that never happened. It turned out that shaming was such an integral part of the judicial process, the day was pretty much all about it. In the afternoon, the experts were taught shame avoidance techniques. When they first entered the dock, John told them, they should ask the court usher to bring them a glass of water. They mustn't pour the water themselves, but instead ask the court usher to. When the lawyer asks them a question, they should swivel on their hips and deliver the answer to the judge. They'll have a much harder time breaking you down that way, John said. Oddly enough, we like to look at our tormentors. Maybe it's linked into the Stockholm syndrome. The day ended with a mock cross-examination, a chance for the rookie experts to enact what they had learnt. Matthew, the marine mythologist, was first to the fake witness stand. John asked me to pretend to be the judge. Everyone smiled supportively at Matthew. He was a young man, wearing a pink shirt and a pink tie. He was shaking a little. He poured himself a glass of water. The water in the glass shook like a pond during a minor earth tremor. He forgot to ask the usher to pour him a glass of water, I thought. Tell me your qualifications, said John, taking the role of the cross-examining lawyer. I have an upper second class degree, in metallurgy, said Matthew, looking John in the eye. Then he bowed his head like a geisha. Why is he not turning to face me? I thought. Matthew's role play lasted 15 minutes. His face turned as crimson as a rusted cargo container as he mumbled about corroded coils. His mouth was dry, his voice trembling. He was a wreck. He's weak, I heard myself think. He's just so weak. Then I caught myself, judging a person on how flustered they appear in the face of a shaming is a truly strange and arbitrary way of forming an opinion on someone. I started to correspond with a woman from the Scottish town of New Cumnock. Her name was Linda Armstrong. One September night, Linda's 16-year-old daughter, Lindsay, was on her way home from a nearby bowling alley when a 14-year-old boy from the town followed her off the bus, coaxed her into a park, pushed her to the ground and raped her. At the boy's trial, Lindsay was cross-examined by his lawyer, John Carruthers. Linda sent me a copy of the court transcript. I have never read it, she wrote to me, because I couldn't face it. Lindsay Armstrong. He started following behind me, and he was asking me out and everything, and I kept saying no, and then I walked away from him, and then he followed behind me, and he pulled my arm like that, and he started trying to kiss me and everything, and I kept shoving him away. I told him to leave me alone, and then he shoved me down. John Carruthers. I wonder if we could see label number 7, please. Do you recognise those? Lindsay Armstrong. Uh-huh. John Carruthers. What are they? Lindsay Armstrong. My pants. John Carruthers. Those are the pants that you were wearing that day. Lindsay Armstrong. Uh-huh. John Carruthers. I wonder if you could hold them up to allow people to see them. Would it be fair to describe those pants as flimsy? Lindsay Armstrong. I don't think what kind of pants I wear has anything to do with... John Carruthers. Well, hold them up again. It has got a name, the design of it, hasn't it? What's it called? Is it not a thong? Lindsay Armstrong. Yes. John Carruthers. I beg your pardon, Miss Armstrong, if I could ask you to hold them up... Lindsay Armstrong. Sorry. John Carruthers. Now you can see through those pants. Is that correct? Lindsay Armstrong. Uh-huh. John Carruthers. What does it say on the front? Lindsay Armstrong. Little devil. John Carruthers. Sorry? Lindsay Armstrong. Little devil. Lindsay told me she was disgusted and very embarrassed about him making her hold up her underwear, Linda emailed me. She said she put them back down quickly and he shouted at her to pick them up again, purely to let the jury see what type of underwear she wore. I think this was probably the most stressful part of the cross-examination for her, as she didn't ever want to see those clothes again. There was absolutely no need for her to read out what was written on the front of them. The boy was found guilty. He was sentenced to 4 years in a young offenders institution. He eventually served 2. 3 weeks after Lindsay's cross-examination, her parents found her in her bedroom at 2 a.m. She had put on Bohemian Rhapsody and had taken a lethal overdose of antidepressants. A shaming can be like a distorting mirror at a funfair, taking human nature and making it look monstrous. Of course, it was tactics like John Carruthers that compelled us to believe that we could do justice better on social media. But still, knee-jerk shaming is knee-jerk shaming, and I wondered what would happen if we made a point of eschewing the shaming completely, if we refused to shame anyone. Could there be a corner of the justice system trying out an idea like that? It turned out that there was, and it was being run by about the last person you'd expect. Chapter 13. Raquel in a post-shaming world. A little boy and his father were eating breakfast at an almost deserted restaurant in the meatpacking districts of Manhattan when they became aware of a man dashing across the floor towards them. He seemed to have something urgent to say. The boy looked anxious at what might happen next. The stranger took a breath. "Study hard at math," he yelled. There was a silence. "Okay," the boy said. At this, the man walked over to me and sat down, pleased to have had the chance to positively motivate a child. His phone rang. "Sorry," he mouthed. He picked it up. "Did you do 10 strong powerfuls last night?" he hollered down the receiver. "Word of honour, good for you, love you, bye." He put the phone down. Then he smiled, delighted that this was proving such a gold rush morning for him in terms of imparting inspirational messages. His name was Jim McGreevy. He used to be the governor of New Jersey. He'd been a severe one too. "I never pardoned anyone," he told me. "How does the pardoning process even work?" I asked him. "The Attorney General's office makes a recommendation," he replied. "They contact the local prosecutor, who contacts the parole officer of the person being considered for a pardon, who makes an official recommendation to the governor, who was me." I pictured the prisoners in their cells, concentrating hard on their letters to Jim, frantically wondering how best to lay out their mitigating circumstances. What would draw Jim in? What would grab the attention of the governor? "Can you remember any of their stories?" I asked Jim. "I never read any of them," he said. "You never even looked?" Jim shook his head. "You were like a hanging judge," I said. "I was a law and order Democrat," Jim said. Bill and Hillary Clinton had campaigned for Jim back in 2001. He was young, handsome, married with two beautiful daughters. He won a landslide victory and took his place at the heart of the New Jersey power elite, as close, as he'd later described the state in his memoirs, to Machiavelli's cutthroat Venetian principality as anywhere on earth. It was a place where political meetings start with a big bear hug, so both huggers could surreptitiously check the other one for a concealed wire. A New Jersey pat-down among friends. Now Jim had a beach house, a helicopter, a staff of cooks, and Drumthwacket, the governor's mansion. Jim considered himself awesome. He was inviolable. This was just after 9/11. He'd turn up at places like the offices of the Bergen Record, North Jersey's regional newspaper, and hold forth, lording it over the journalists, making grand pronouncements like, "We will not skimp on security. We've even employed a security advisor from the Israeli Defence Forces, the best of the best." Then he'd swan off, thinking how well it had gone, unaware that the editorial board of the Bergen Record was now wondering why on earth the governor of New Jersey had employed a man from the Israeli Defence Forces to advise on local security. When Jim was a young boy, he'd lie in his tent at summer camp and think I was hearing people in other tents call me a faggot and then realise that they were. Jim stirred his coffee. "It's funny how these things just stay." "They really stay," I said. "My life as a 15 and 16-year-old never leaves me." We looked at each other then, me and Jim, two middle-aged men in a coffee shop in New York City. Jim grew up, went to Columbia University, and would sometimes walk all the way down from 116th Street to the meatpacking district to look into the windows of the gay bars. But he couldn't bring himself to go inside, and he'd walk back up to 116th Street. He grew up to be an assistant prosecutor, a prosecutor's prosecutor, and a town mayor. He'd read books on how to stop having gay thoughts. As a state assemblyman, he voted against gay marriage. He lost his first election campaign for the governorship by just 27,000 votes. When he was campaigning for the second time, he went on a diplomatic junket to Israel, where he found himself at a lunch in some rural town. The man sitting next to him introduced himself. His name was Golan, he said, and he worked for the local mayor. "I followed your campaign very closely," Golan told Jim. 27,000 votes is a very narrow margin." Jim was, he'd later write, "flattered beyond anything I'd ever experienced before. Nobody commits to memory the demographic standings of a politician halfway around the world." Jim fell in love with Golan. He told him that if he came to New Jersey, he'd give him an important concocted job title like special counselor to the governor. Golan agreed, and on his arrival in America, demanded an especially opulent office that had already been allocated to another member of Jim's staff. Jim gave Golan the office. A few weeks after Jim's visit to the Bergen Record, the newspaper published a profile of the unexpected Israeli staff member, referring to Golan as a sailor, he had once been in the Israeli Navy, and a poet, he'd written a collection of poems in high school. Jim feared they might be using code words, but he didn't know for sure, and he couldn't talk to anyone about it. His staff was acting like nothing was different, but that didn't mean nothing was different. "People don't say things to governors that they don't think governors want to hear," he told me. Jim distanced himself from Golan. He told him he needed him to quit his job for the good of the administration. Golan was devastated. He had envisaged a great career in US politics, and now Jim was throwing him on the fire to save his own career. A few weeks later, a letter arrived for Jim. It was from Golan's lawyer. Golan was threatening to sue Jim for sexual assault and harassment. "When I got that letter, I had this vision of my grandmother's china cabinet," Jim told me, "and all the china was just smashing." After 3 years in power, it was over for Jim. He called a press conference. "I am a gay American," he announced. He confessed the affair, resigned the governorship, stepped off the stage and checked himself into the Meadows, an Arizona clinic, and was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. "Oh, you met James Gilligan?" Jim said to me in the restaurant. "Oh, I love Gilligan. I love Gilligan." In fact, I had met James Gilligan at the very beginning of my journey, a few days after Joan Allera had made his disastrous apology speech at the Knight Foundation lunch. Gilligan is in late middle age now, with the worried face and wispy hair and wired-rimmed glasses of the East Coast psychiatrist he is. I sat with him in the communal courtyard of his apartment in New York City's West Village. He's about the world's best-informed chronicler of what a shaming can do to our inner lives, which is why he's so opposed to its renaissance on social media. I wanted to learn how he came to make it his life's work. Back in the 1970s, Gilligan told me, he was a young psychiatrist at the Harvard Medical School. His days were spent treating middle-class neurotics like you and me. He was completely uninterested in the strange epidemic that was occurring within Massachusetts prisons and mental hospitals of suicides and homicides and riots and hostage-taking and fire-setting and everything you can imagine that was dangerous. Prisoners were getting killed, officers were getting killed, visitors were getting killed. It was completely out of control during the entire decade of the 1970s. There was a murder a month in one prison alone, and a suicide every 6 weeks. Inmates were swallowing razor blades and blinding and castrating themselves and each other. A US District Court judge, W. Arthur Garrity, ordered the Department of Corrections to make sense of the chaos by bringing in a team of investigative psychiatrists. Gilligan was invited to lead the group. He agreed, but he wasn't enthusiastic. He assumed the perpetrators of the prison violence would be psychopaths. "I'd been taught that psychopaths had just been born that way," he said, "and that they'd only want to manipulate you so you get them a reduced sentence." He pictured them like they were another species, and that's exactly how they seemed to him when he first went into the Bridgewater State Hospital for the criminally insane. "One of the first men I met had been a pimp in a slum area of Boston," Gilligan said. "He killed some of his girls, and he killed other people. He killed several people in the community before he was finally arrested, so they put him in the Charles Street jail to await trial, and he promptly killed one of the inmates there. So they said, 'He's too violent to await trial in the jail. We have to send him to Walpole, the maximum security prison.' And he killed someone there, and that's where I met him. He looked like a zombie. He was mute, rather paranoid, not overtly psychotic, but literally abnormal. Everyone was scared to death of him. I thought, this guy's untreatable. But we needed to keep people safe, so we put him in a locked dormitory building, and during the day I told the staff, 'Keep an invisible wall around him. Keep 6 feet away from him. Don't crowd him. If you crowd him, you might get injured.' And that's how things remained for a while. But eventually the man, and other men like him, loosened up a little to Gilligan. And what they told him came as a great surprise to him. The men would all say that they had died, Gilligan said. These were the most incorrigibly violent characters. They would all say that they themselves had died before they started killing other people. What they meant was that their personalities had died. They felt dead inside. They had no capacity for feelings, no emotional feelings, or even physical feelings, so some would cut themselves or they would mutilate themselves in the most horrible ways, not because they felt guilty. This wasn't a penance for their sins, but because they wanted to see if they had feelings. They found their inner numbness more tormenting than even the physical pain would be. Gilligan filled notebooks with observations from his interviews with the men. He wrote, "Some have told me that they feel like robots or zombies, that their bodies are empty or filled with straw, not flesh and blood, that instead of having veins and nerves, they have ropes or cords. One inmate told me he feels like food that is decomposing. These men's souls did not just die. They have dead souls because their souls were murdered. How did it happen? How were they murdered?" This was, he felt, the mystery he'd been invited inside Massachusetts prisons and mental hospitals to solve. And one day it hit him. Universal among the violent criminals was the fact that they were keeping a secret, Gilligan wrote. A central secret, and the secret was that they felt ashamed. Deeply ashamed, chronically ashamed, acutely ashamed. It was shame every time. "I have yet to see a serious act of violence that was not provoked by the experience of feeling shamed or humiliated, disrespected and ridiculed. As children, these men were shot, axed, scalded, beaten, strangled, tortured, drugged, starved, suffocated, set on fire, thrown out of the window, raped or prostituted by mothers who were their pimps. For others, words alone shamed and rejected, insulted and humiliated, dishonoured and disgraced, tore down their self-esteem and murdered their soul. For each of them, the shaming occurred on a scale so extreme, so bizarre, and so frequent that one cannot fail to see that the men who occupy the extreme end of the continuum of violent behaviour in adulthood occupied an equally extreme end of the continuum of violent child abuse earlier in life. So they grew up and, all violence being a person's attempt to replace shame with self-esteem, they murdered people. One inmate told him, "You wouldn't believe how much respect you get when you have a gun pointed at some dude's face." For men who have lived a lifetime on a diet of contempt and disdain, the temptation to gain instant respect in this way can be worth far more than the cost of going to prison or even of dying. And after they were jailed, things only got worse. At Walpole, Massachusetts' most riot-prone prison during the 1970s, officers intentionally flooded the cells and put insects in the prisoners' food. They forced inmates to lie face down before they were allowed meals. Sometimes officers would tell prisoners they had a visitor. Prisoners almost never had visitors, so it was exciting to hear. And then the officers would say he didn't really have a visitor and he was just kidding, and so on. They thought these things would be how to get them to obey, Gilligan told me, but it did the exact opposite. It stimulated violence. "Literally every killer told you this," I asked, "that the feeling of shame was what led them to do it." "It amazed me how universal it was," Gilligan replied. "Over decades." "What about that pimp from Boston?" I said. "What was his story?" "His mother had thought he was possessed by the devil," Gilligan said, "so she did voodoo ceremonies and exorcisms in this totally black basement and he was scared to death. He'd shit his pants. He certainly was not loved in any normal sense. His mother had given him this negative identity that Satan was inside him, and so he behaved accordingly." Gilligan paused. "It took some of them a while to confess it to me. It's shameful to have to admit you feel ashamed. By the way, we're saying the word feeling. The feeling of shame. I think feeling is the wrong word." It may be somewhat paradoxical to refer to shame as a feeling, for while shame is initially painful, constant shaming leads to a deadening of feeling. Shame, like cold, is, in essence, the absence of warmth. And when it reaches overwhelming intensity, shame is experienced, like cold, as a feeling of numbness and deadness. In Dante's Inferno, the lowest circle of hell was a region not of flames, but of ice, absolute coldness. James Gilligan, Violence, Reflections on Our Deadliest Epidemic, 1999. "And finally it struck me," Gilligan said to me, "our language tells us this. One of the words we use for overwhelming shame is mortification. I'm mortified." Their bodies are empty or filled with straw, not flesh and blood, but instead of having veins and nerves, they have ropes or cords. As Gilligan said this to me, I remembered a moment from Jonah Lehrer's Annihilation. It was when Jonah was standing in front of that giant screen Twitter feed, trying to apologize. He looked deeply uncomfortable, being the sort of person who finds displays of emotion extremely embarrassing. "I hope that when I tell my young daughter the same story I've just told you," he was saying, "I will be a better person." "He is tainted as a writer forever," replied the tweets. "He has not proven that he is capable of feeling shame. Jonah Lehrer is a frigging sociopath." Later, when Jonah and I talked about that moment, he told me that he had to turn off some emotional switch in me. I think I had to shut down. Jonah had a house in the Hollywood Hills and a wife who loved him. He had enough self-esteem to get him through. But I think, in front of that giant Twitter screen, he felt for an instant the same deadness that Gilligan's prisoners had described. I have felt it too. I know exactly what Jonah and Gilligan meant when they talked about shutting down. That moment, pain turns to numbness. James Gilligan has led a distinguished life, President Clinton and the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan appointed him to sit on advisory committees on the causes of violence. Martin Scorsese based Ben Kingsley's character in Shutter Island on him. But for all his accolades, I left Gilligan's apartment thinking that he hadn't considered his life's work a success. There was a time when he might have totally changed the way the United States treats its transgressors. But it didn't happen. This is the reason why. Throughout the 1980s, Gilligan ran experimental therapeutic communities inside Massachusetts prisons. They weren't especially radical. They were just about treating the prisoners with respect, Gilligan told me, giving people a chance to express their grievances and hopes and wishes and fears. The point was to create an ambience that eradicated shame entirely. We had one psychiatrist who referred to the inmates as scum, Gilligan said. I told him I never wanted to see his face again. It was not only anti-therapeutic for the patients, it was dangerous for us. At first the prison officers had been suspicious, but eventually some of them began to envy the prisoners, Gilligan said. Many of them also needed psychiatric help. These were poorly paid guys, poorly educated. We arranged to get some of them into psychiatric treatment, so they became less insulting and domineering, and violence dropped astoundingly. Even apparently hopeless cases were transformed, Gilligan told me. Even that pimp from Boston. After he joined our program, he discovered a profoundly retarded 18-year-old young man. The boy could hardly tie his shoelaces, so he took care of him. He started protecting him. He'd take him to and from the dining hall. He made sure other inmates didn't harm him. I was, thank God, this could be this guy's road back to humanity. I told the staff, leave this alone. Their relationship built and matured. And he has a life now. He has not harmed a hair on anybody's head in 25 years. He acts like a normal human being. He's not going anywhere. He's not normal enough to ever go back to the community. But he wouldn't want to. He knows he couldn't make it. He doesn't have the psychological wherewithal, the self-control, but he has reclaimed a level of humanity that I never thought was possible. He works in the prison mental hospital. He's useful to other people. And when I go back to visit, he smiles and says, hello, Dr. Gilligan, how are you? Gilligan paused. I could tell you 100 stories like that. We'd had men who had blinded themselves by banging their heads against the wall. In 1991, Gilligan began to co-opt Harvard lecturers to donate their time for free to teach classes inside his prisons. What could be more de-shaming than an educational program? His plan coincided with the election of a new governor, William Weld. Weld was asked about Gilligan's initiatives in one of his first press conferences. He said, "We have to stop this idea of giving free college education to inmates," Gilligan told me. "Otherwise people who are too poor to go to college are going to start committing crimes so they can get sent to prison for a free education." And so that was the end of the education program. He literally decimated it, Gilligan said. He stripped it. I didn't want to preside over a sham. And so Gilligan quit. As the years passed, he became for prison reformers a figure of nostalgia. Only a handful of therapeutic communities inspired by his Massachusetts ones exist in American prisons today. But as it happens, one of them is situated on the top floor of the Hudson County Correctional Center in Kearney, New Jersey, and it is being quietly run by the former New Jersey governor, Jim McGreevy. The non-therapeutic lower floors of the Hudson County Correctional Center are drab and brown, like the ugly parts of a municipal leisure complex, a long corridor from a changing room to a swimming pool that will never be there. Down here is where New Jersey keeps its suspected immigration offenders. In November 2012, it was declared one of the 10 worst immigration detention facilities in America, according to a Detention Watch Network report. Some of the guards down here reportedly called the detainees animals and laughed at them and subjected them to unnecessary strip searches. The report added, Many immigrants also noted that corrections officers appeared to bring their personal problems to work, taking their frustration and anger out on them. "Every day is a blessed day," Jim hollered at a suspected immigration offender who was mopping the floor. The man looked startled. He smiled uneasily. We kept walking, past inmates just sitting there, looking at walls. "Normal prisoners, punishment in the worst sense," Jim told me. "It's like a soul bleeding. Day in, day out, people find themselves doing virtually nothing in a very negative environment." I thought of Lindsay Stone, just sitting at her kitchen table for almost a year, staring at the online shamings of people just like her. "People move away from themselves," Jim said. "Inmates tell me time and again that they feel themselves shutting down, building a wall." Jim and I walked into an elevator. An inmate was already in there. Everyone was quiet. "Every day is a blessed day," said Jim. More silence. "Watch your character. It becomes your destiny," said Jim. We reached the top floor. The doors opened. "You go first," said Jim. "Oh no, please, you," said the inmate. "No, you," said Jim. "Oh no, you," said the inmate. We all stood there. The inmate went first. Jim gave me a happy smile. The first time I'd met Jim, when he'd yelled, "Study hard at math," at a startled stranger child, I'd found him a bit nuts. But somewhere along the line, he'd become heroic to me. I'd been thinking about a message that had appeared on the giant Twitter feed behind Jonah's head. "He is tainted as a writer forever." And a tweet directed at Justine Sacco. "Your tweet lives on forever." The word forever had been coming up a lot during my 2 years amongst the publicly shamed. Jonah and Justine and people like them were being told, no, there is no door. There is no way back in. We don't offer any forgiveness. But we know that people are complicated and have a mixture of flaws and talents and sins. So why do we pretend that we don't know this? Amidst all the agony, Jim McGreevy was trying an extraordinary thing. In front of us was a giant locked dormitory room. Inside were 40 women. This was Jim's therapeutic unit. We waited for somebody to let us in. "Unlike downstairs," Jim said, "his women are up at 8:30 a.m. They all have chores. Everybody works. They're all assigned physical tasks. Then there are workshops on sex abuse, domestic violence, anger management, then lunch. Then in the afternoon they focus in on job training, housing. There are books. There's cake. There's the library. Then the mothers can read bedtime nursery rhymes to their children over Skype." There were glimpses of a summer day through the windows, and as a corrections officer let us in, she said that tensions were high, because warm days are when a person really feels incarcerated. Jim gathered the women into a circle for a group meeting. I wasn't allowed to record it, and so I managed only to scribble down fragments of conversations like, "I come from a small town, so everyone knows where I am, and that tears me up inside, and most people know why Raquel is in here." At that, a few women glanced over at the woman I took to be Raquel. Their look seemed wary and deferential. Pretty much every woman here was in for drugs or prostitution, but the comment and the glances made me think that, with Raquel, it was something else. Raquel's eyes darted around the room. She fidgeted a lot. The other women were stiller. I wondered what Raquel had done, but I didn't know the etiquette of how to ask. And then as soon as the meeting broke up, Raquel immediately dashed across the room to me and told me everything. I somehow managed to get it all down, note-taking frantically like a secretary in Mad Men. "I was born in Puerto Rico," she said. "I was sexually abused from the age of 4. When I was 6, we moved to New Jersey. Every memory I have of growing up is a memory of being punched in the face and told I was worthless. When I was 15, my brother broke my nose. When I was 16, I had my first boyfriend. 3 months later, I was married. I started smoking pot, drinking. I cheated on my husband. I left him. 18-19 was a big blur. I tried heroin. Thank God I don't have an addictive personality. I drank like a fish. We'd go to bars, wait for people to come out, take their money, and make fun of how they screamed for their moms. Suddenly, holy shit, I'm pregnant. I'm pregnant with the only thing that's ever going to love me. My son was born 25th January 1996. I went to business school, dropped out, I had a daughter, we moved to Florida. In Florida we'd have water fights, movie nights, I'd buy all their favourite food and lay it all out on the bed and we'd pile in and watch movies until we all passed out. We played baseball in the rain. My son loves comedy, drama, he sings, he won a talent show when he was 14. I would make him do his homework over and over. I used to make him do 5-page reports, read encyclopedias. I shoved him out of the bed when he was 14 and slapped him. A girl had texted him, "Are you a virgin?" I was ballistic. I slapped the shit out of him and left nail marks. 10 months ago, Raquel sent her children to stay with their father in Florida for a vacation. As she watched them walk down the tunnel towards the plane, her son suddenly turned and called back at her. "How much do you want to bet that I don't come back?" Then he said, "Just kidding." Raquel yelled back at him, "How much do you want to bet you don't get on that plane?" Her son walked on a few more steps. Then he called back, "We should make that bet." "And that was the last thing he ever said to me," Raquel said. That Friday, the Department of Children and Families turned up at Raquel's house. Her son was accusing her of child abuse. "He used to ask me if he could stay out until 9 p.m., Raquel said. "I'd say no. He'd ask why not. I'd say there are people out there that can hurt you, but I was hurting him more than anyone. Thank God they got away from me when they did. He's safe. He's getting a chance to be a teenager. He's a very angry boy because I made him that way. My daughter is very shy, withdrawn, because I made her that way. I just pray they'll be normal." For the first few months of Raquel's incarceration, she was downstairs on a non-therapeutic floor. "What was that like?" I asked her. "Downstairs is chaos," she replied. "It's borderline barbaric. Downstairs, girls get slapped with the food trays. Some girl decides she doesn't like you. She'll pull you into a room and lock the door and you'll fight, and whoever comes out unbroken wins. Up here we eat coffee cake. We watch TV. We spread books across the table. It's like we're in a college cafeteria sipping our coffee. Sophisticated." Just then there was a commotion. A woman behind us had collapsed and was having a seizure. She was carried away on a stretcher. "Feel better," some of the other women shouted after her. "Last call for medications," an officer called out. Jim and I left the prison and walked back towards his car. "How long do you think Raquel will stay in prison?" I asked him. "We'll know more in 2 weeks," he replied. "That's when we're due to hear from the prosecutor. My guess is a few more months." Jim said he'd pass on the news when he heard it, that he drove me to the train station. I didn't hear from Jim 2 weeks later, so I emailed. "How did things go with Raquel?" Jim emailed back. "She received difficult news yesterday, an 8-count indictment. She's in significant emotional pain." I telephoned him. "What are they charging her with?" I asked. "Attempted murder in the first degree," Jim replied. He sounded shaken. "She threw a knife at her son. They're going for a 20-year jail sentence." 6 months later, three people sat together in the council chamber at Newark City Hall. Me, Jim, and Raquel. Jim had intervened. The prosecutors were persuaded that Raquel was the victim of an abuse cycle, and so instead of 20 years, she served 4 more months, and then they let her go. If shaming worked, if prison worked, then it would work, Jim said to me. But it doesn't work. He paused. Look, some people need to go to prison forever. Some people are incapable, but most people... It's disorienting, I said, that the line between hell and redemption in the US justice system is so fine. It's public defenders that are overwhelmed and prosecutors that are just following guidelines, Jim said. This has been a book about people who really didn't do very much wrong. Justine and Lindsay, certainly, were destroyed for nothing more than telling bad jokes. And while we were busy steadfastly refusing them forgiveness, Jim was quietly arranging the salvation of someone who had committed a far more serious offence. It struck me that if de-shaming would work for a maelstrom like Raquel, if it would restore someone like her to health, we'd really need to think twice about raining down vengeance and anger as our default position. It wasn't freedom without boundaries for Raquel. She'd been banned from contacting her children for 5 years. Her son would be 22 then, her daughter 17. So even when she's 17, any contact will have to be okayed with their father, Raquel told me, because my parental rights have been stripped. But still, she gets updates. My friends from Florida are still friends with them. My friend actually called me yesterday and said, "You will never guess who is Facebooking me right now." I said, "Who?" She said, "Your daughter." I said, "No way." My daughter is sending her messages and she's sitting there reading them to me. So apparently my daughter has a little crush on someone. He's got a cleft in his chin. He's got sandy brown hair. I told Raquel it was nice to see her in such a good mood. And that's when she told me her other news. Yesterday, when group was over, Miss Blake called me into her office. Miss Blake was the manager of Raquel's halfway house. She said, "Raquel, I've seen how you carry yourself, how the guys listen to you. I want to offer you a job here. Can you get me your resume?" Raquel replied, "As luck would have it, I have a resume right here." Then Raquel said, "Miss Blake, is this really happening?" And Miss Blake nodded. I got a call from Michael Furtick's people. They were ready to start on Lindsay Stone. Chapter 14. Cats and Ice Cream and Music. Are there any hobbies you're particularly passionate about right now? Marathons? Photography? Farouk Rashid in San Francisco was talking down a conference line to Lindsay Stone. I was listening in from my sofa in New York. I'd met Farouk a few months earlier when Michael's publicist Leslie Hobbs gave me a tour of the Reputation.com offices. Two open-plan floors with soundproofed booths for the sensitive calls to the celebrity clients. She introduced me to Farouk and explained that he usually works on Michael's VIP customers, the CEOs and celebrities. "It's nice that you're giving Lindsay the bespoke service," I said. "She needs it," Leslie replied. She really did. Michael's strategists had been researching Lindsay's online life and had discovered literally nothing about her besides that silence and respect incident. "That 5 seconds of her life is her entire internet presence," I said. Farouk nodded. "And it's not just this Lindsay Stone. Anyone that has that name has the same problem. There are 60 Lindsay Stones in the United States. There's a designer in Austin, Texas, a photographer, there's even a gymnast, and they're all being defined by that one photograph." "I'm sorry to have given you such a tricky one," I said, feeling a little proud of myself. "Oh no, we're excited," Farouk replied. "It's a challenging scenario, but a great scenario. We're going to introduce the internet to the real Lindsay Stone." "Are cats important to you?" Farouk asked Lindsay now down the conference line. "Absolutely," said Lindsay. I heard Farouk type the word cats into his computer. Farouk was young and energetic and just as upbeat and buoyant and lacking in cynicism and malevolent irony as he was hoping to make Lindsay seem. His Twitter profile said he enjoys biking, hiking and family time. His plan was to create Lindsay Stone Tumblrs and LinkedIn pages and WordPress blogs and Instagram accounts and YouTube accounts to overwhelm that terrible photograph, wash it away in a tidal wave of positivity.